Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we try to make sense out of the nonsense and bring just a little bit of sanity to your week.
So the quote of the week, Ari, is from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who was responding to the conflict that's arisen around Chinese trade policy. And he said, quote, "Make no mistake, this is China versus the world. They have put these unacceptable export controls on the entire world. China is a command and control economy, and we and our allies will neither be commanded nor controlled." He later went on to say that he didn't want to decouple from China, but just de-risk, you know, sort of modifying his tone a little bit there. But then that same day, President Trump in a press conference was asked about the situation and if he feared that his, you know, back and forth with China would lead to a trade war. And his response was, "You're already in one." Mm-hmm. So it's a really important story to watch. I guess we're in a trade war with China. I think people probably suspected that we already were, but to have him say it was interesting, and to have the Secretary of the Treasury really put his foot down in this way, I think is important, and it's an important moment.
Yeah, I mean, I love that line, "We will neither be commanded nor controlled." Yeah. It's a really good line. And there's so much to say about China, and I think hopefully we'll have, you know, someone on to really dive deep into it. Yeah. I think it's a huge story. I think one of the interesting things now is sort of America shifting its posture, taking stakes in companies, being more aggressive in intervening in strategic industries as a way to counter China. For a long time, it was kind of like, well, our model of sort of laissez-faire, hands-off, free market is the best way to counter. It's interesting to think, like, are we learning from China? Are we sort of like adapting our strategy to address those weaknesses?
It's a combination of that being President Trump's agenda and strategy, and also you know, when they were just stopping, you know, all imports of our soybeans and hurting our farmers, we kind of said meh, and, you know, we're going to subsidize the farmers. But the minute they hit the rare earth sector, it feels like Trump said no more, right? Yeah. And so it's really also about the sectors that they're hitting and the importance to our economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of and we'll dive into it when we get to our top story is sort of, does the Trump, you know, MO, you know, that works, that seems to have worked already in Gaza and Israel, can that work elsewhere? You know, and we'll see that pretty soon, I think, with this meeting with Zelensky tomorrow.
Right.
So Trump's definitely on a winning streak. He's definitely on a heater. Question is, are the, you know, is this a method that can be applied in different ways, you know, with positive results? And I think China is a big, China and Russia, Ukraine are maybe the two biggest areas, I think, where success could yield real dividends. So anyway, our top story this week is we'll continue to break down the developments in the Middle East, but not only the Middle East. We're also going to look to our own hemisphere and try to get a handle on what's going on with Venezuela, which a story that feels like it's kind of, you know, hit critical mass now and is really heating up. For our Make It Make Sense section, we're gonna talk voting rights. Big oral arguments yesterday at the Supreme Court over the Voting Rights Act. It's one of those legal cases that also is deeply tied to kind of like American history and the American story. So it's not just kind of dry statutes, but I think really cuts to a lot of how we understand this country and where it is and where it's going. And then we'll finish, as we always do, with our sunlight and sunburns. Also very exciting, Rebecca, we're interviewing in a live taping of Sanity. Everyone invited. Sunday morning, the former Prime Minister of the UK, Liz Truss, she'll give us the inside scoop on 10 Downing Street, on Buckingham Palace, all the political and hot button issues that we spoke about with Ben Habib last week, and that really set to matter, as well as her relationship with Donald Trump and the special relationship between our two countries. So, Rebecca, you know, the Gaza deal, I think we talked about it last time. It was sort of coming together. thank God the hostages are home.
The live hostages.
The live hostages. Yeah. And we'll get to those who have not been returned. I could watch those videos all day of the joyousness of the return. And, you know, that this was a wound in the Israeli soul. And it's, you know, hopefully now at least a little bit, healed. And I think the brilliance of this agreement, you know, is that, you know, Israel is still in Gaza, at least partially. You know, and so to have gotten the live hostages home while still retaining the ability to monitor, surveil, and even act if need be was a major achievement of this administration, one that is being applauded by everyone from Egypt to, you know, Bibi to the New York Times. So it's right. Really,
but
really
not Zoran Mamdani.
Not Zoran Mamdani. You know, I just find, you know, can I just say, I mean,
I didn't mean to trigger you.
We'll get to our next mayor soon. Yeah. But and the outstanding issue now with the deal is the bodies of the, you know, the hostages who have been killed, you know, and Israelis don't,
and the disarming of Hamas, which hasn't
happened. The disarming of Hamas and Israelis, you know, don't really make a distinction between the living and the dead. I mean, all of these are hostages. All of these are Israeli citizens. All of these deserve burial and return to their families. So this isn't something where they're going to just kind of say, okay, whatever. I mean, this is still, mm-hmm. you know, at the core of what needs to happen. But what are some of your reflections now? We've had a couple of days and we're on to phase two. We're midway between phase one and phase two.
Yeah, I guess the number one thing to say is about the live hostages who were returned, and of course, very emotional, very moving, unbelievable to see them even functioning and speaking and articulating sentences, and the strength and the absolute, I don't know, will to live is extraordinary. And, you know, every eye was not dry, let's say, watching those videos. The first thing that I kind of noticed was that this was being presented and packaged as a peace deal. I didn't see it as a peace deal. It was a hostage deal, the return of hostages.
And Rebecca has a great column about this. Yeah. You should really read. Yeah,
just in exchange for, you know, murderers and terrorists and for a cessation of IDF strikes, we got our hostages back. And I'm not sorry that we did. But I also am conscious of the fact that, you know, the document that was signed in Sharm el-Sheikh was not the 20-point plan. It was just sort of vague language about a future and potential for peace and aspirations toward peace. So, you know, I'm not trying to throw a wet rag on a happy day, but it's not clear to me that we have a peace plan yet. And I think we should be careful about what that looks like and how it might unfold and what the real cost to Israel could be. I want to say also that what I found really interesting is before the last couple of weeks when the 20-point plan has been discussed, the two countries that we were talking about the most in the Middle East were Saudi Arabia and the UAE in terms of being partners. All of a sudden now it's Qatar and Turkey. Mm-hmm. Two countries have taken the center stage with President Trump. And I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know that that was necessarily a great trade. It might have been in terms of those being the two countries who could get the hostages
and get Hamas to
returned.
The
table. But I'm not so sure going forward that that's going to be a good thing for Israel. Mm-hmm. So again, I think what we're seeing on the outside is what we're seeing and what we are able to know. The real deal-making has been going on behind the scenes, and we don't know mm-hmm. what's been promised to whom and what carrots and sticks have been used. Mm-hmm. And that's where the real meat is. And so it's hard to comment on the future, and it's always hard to comment in the Middle East mm-hmm. in the future. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that Turkey and Qatar are... I am sure.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm pretty sure that they're
I'm pretty sure
not
that
great
they're
actors.
Not yeah. Great actors. So yeah. Let's tread cautiously. And yeah. And this deal has already been violated so many times by Hamas with not returning the hostages, not disarming. Let's see what
yeah.
happens.
Yeah, I think, you know, the both the strength of the deal and in a way its limitation is that it detached the hostage issue from these grander sort of longer term plans. Mm-hmm. So that was, I think, a breakthrough. On the other hand, Hamas is exactly who we thought they were. I mean, they've gone back to massive executions, a really lawless, violent terror state. Now, they're a rump terror state now. They've been diminished. But, you know, that their DNA is the same.
Yeah.
Their just ability to inflict harm, not on their own citizens, but on Israel, has been diminished for now. So there's a real question here of like, you know, and I was heartened by some reporting out of the White House that suggested, you know, people saying, we know this is going to be hard, right? Dearming Hamas, disarming Hamas. We know this is a tricky, we know we have to be creative, because it's not like walking up and saying, can I please have your guns,
yeah,
right? I mean, so what does that even mean? One strategy that I saw is, well, reconstruction will begin in areas not controlled by Hamas as a way to sort of isolate and marginalize Hamas. So I think there are things that can be done here. As you said, there's no utopia. You know, every prediction of a new Middle East is always, you know, foundered against reality.
Yeah, leading with economics, as you're suggesting, yeah, is Trump's strategy, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting new way to go. It's not been tried before. And maybe that's where the hope is, although I'm very reluctant to put too much hope in this yet, you know, for everybody who's been through Oslo and, mm-hmm, you know, hope and what we wanted it to be kind of blinded everyone to what it actually was. And mm-hmm, I'm very afraid of whatever they're calling the Board of Peace. I mean, we've joked about Tony Blair being part of it, but it's no joke. And whenever these sort of large international institutions are set up, you know, they don't work, mm-hmm, the way they ever say they're going to work. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they're helpful. They're usually harmful. And mm-hmm, so I just, a lot about this makes me nervous.
Mm-hmm. No, and there's plenty to be nervous about. I think mostly that Hamas, and not only Hamas, but Hamas and its enablers, its supporters, its constituency are unchanged. And so you haven't, you know, there's no getting rid of that problem. I think, you know, one thing maybe to be a little bit heartened by is I think Israel's paradigm has shifted. You know, it's no longer just containment or naivete, or like you think of Oslo. It's now sort of aggressive, forward-leaning defense, right? I mean, we saw that this morning, news just breaking that chief of staff of the Houthis has been killed,
yes,
from that strike. So I don't think, you know, Israel will be hesitant to sort of do what it needs to do to keep this issue manageable and contained.
Right, that's, know, right. That's the, those are maybe the 2 points, right, that sort of define Trump's strategy: is economics lead the way and everything else will follow, and military intervention works. The strike on Iran and the strike in Doha by the Israelis mattered, mm-hmm, to people in that region and might have, I don't know if changed their minds, but it certainly changed their behavior. And yeah, so that's the model going forward, not hope and peace and you know, yeah, sort of Rabin kumbaya stuff,
yeah,
but really military intervention and economic incentives.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's worth mentioning just because we covered it a lot, you know, that we had that two-state solution conference at the UN. We had that. And, you know, the way this eventually got done was not that path. It wasn't the UN path. It wasn't the European path.
Yeah.
You know, it was this alternative track,
right,
that really delivered. That delivered results so far. I think the danger, as you said, Rebecca, is that, you know, Trump saying it's over, you know, this is, you know, there has to be the ability to adjust as reality shifts,
yeah,
right? And just saying it's over doesn't make it over.
Yeah,
as
can
you
I
noted.
Just one last comment, please, because The Sun had a great editorial on Benjamin Netanyahu, on, mm-hmm, Bibi, and kind of this is the moment to, for the left in Israel, to do what the left in America has not been able to do, which is get over their Bibi derangement syndrome and, you know, stop the, mm-hmm, lawfare, mm-hmm, stop trying to prosecute him. He's spent the last 2 years of this war going to courtrooms several times a, mm-hmm, week to defend himself against really trivial and silly charges. And this should have been a moment. It wasn't, of course, when Steve Witkoff was in Israel and he thanked Bibi Netanyahu. There was large booing from the,
yeah,
crowd. And I recommend Gadi Tal wrote a really great piece about why that is, because the sort of bring them home movement was captured by the left in Israel, who really, mm-hmm, leveraged, sadly, the hostage situation to attack Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. And all of that ugliness now should really end. And if the left really wants to see a new prime minister in there, the best way to make that happen might be to stop attacking him in the courts. The courts in Israel are notoriously corrupt, the secular courts and the rabbinic courts. And this is just further evidence of it. And they should let it go. And if he needs to ride into the sunset peacefully, let him, so that you can replace him with someone else. But, mm-hmm, doing it this way just is an ugly end to this hostage situation, and there, it shouldn't be ugly. It should be joyous and happy for everybody.
Yeah. Lots to say there. That was a kind of an amazing moment in the Knesset when Trump said, what are we talking about? Cigars and champagne? Yeah, I mean, listen, Israel has elections at the latest next fall. So, you know, it's what we say here. You know, if you want to replace someone, then beat them at the polls, right. You know, and try to figure out what your strategy is, and run good candidates and all these things that the left hasn't done in Israel for decades,
yeah.
You know, and that, you know, obviously Democrats have struggled with here. I will say, you know, I just, there were moments from this week that, you know, have just stood out for me. Obviously, the videos of the hostages return, the joy, you know, reuniting of families. But I thought, you know, that, and it surprised me how affecting I found, you know, Witkoff and Jared and Ivanka's speeches in Hostage Square. I mean, I think
on you or on the Israeli people, you mean?
No, on me. I thought that it was really an amazing moment. Mm-hmm. You know, when Jared said, you know, you haven't descended to the barbarism of your enemies, and there was you know, it wasn't just politics. It was, it felt authentic and real, and that somehow, you know, these bonds, you know, Israel has taken so much criticism and so much hate.
And they still do,
and they
even
still
after
do,
this.
Of course. I mean, that's a whole another thing.
Not
you know?
Shocking.
But yeah, this was a real triumph, I think, of the head and the heart.
Yeah.
In a really nice way. Okay, so let's move a little bit closer to home, and that is a story, you know, I can't say I've been following day in and day out for the past few years, but maybe should be, and that's, you know, our own hemisphere, our own backyard, our own neighborhood, going back to the Monroe Doctrine, mm-hmm. right, which held that America sort of has a role to play in its immediate neighborhood. You know, America's geography is so unique. I mean, having a huge country that's bordered on two sides by oceans means that sometimes I think we don't have a real sense of like what's near and far, or sort of it's been a blessing for us largely. But anyway, just to say that Venezuela is now I think our policy is regime change, right? I mean, no one will kind of say it,
right.
But I thought one of the most amazing moments was when the Nobel laureate from Venezuela,
yes.
you know, thanked President Trump. I mean, sort of really remarkable. You know, there's now I think $50 million, I forget, bounty on Maduro's head. And we've stepped up this military campaign against Venezuela. So
yeah.
It seems like a maximum pressure.
It does. It feels, I think we've talked about this a little bit before, but it feels like, again, this is not just about Venezuela. This is a message to China mm-hmm. that has deep roots with Maduro himself, supporting him politically. Major tens of billions of dollars have been spent by China in loans, too, which they can't pay back to mm-hmm. Venezuela. And the Chinese have a huge interest in the oil fields there. So this is another Trump message to China that you can't take over this neighborhood. We're in charge in this hemisphere, and he's pushing it back. And Argentina is part of that. We just bailed out Argentina with $20 billion purchase of their pesos, in part for that reason. I mean, in part because Trump and Milei have a special relationship, because Milei might be the, you know, Spanish-speaking Trump, but also in part because he and potentially Venezuela and potentially Brazil, where we've been, you know, making noises about the corruption happening
and
there.
And involved there in domestic politics.
That represents a large pushback against China and their interests in our, you know, neck of the woods. So I think it's an important story to follow for American interests for those reasons. And then the drugs and, you know, blowing mm-hmm. boats out of the water. I happen to love the idea of fentanyl dealers being blown out of the water.
Yeah.
But I do kind of hear the argument that perhaps the government should be a little more forthcoming with their evidence that they are blowing the right people out of the water.
Or what's kind of the theory of the case? I mean, you know, this is kind of exactly on the line between kind of foreign policy and, you know, domestic drug enforcement. And, you know, you probably would want, a kind of some general parameter. I mean, are we at war? Are these, you know...
It's a national emergency kind of thing.
It's
international waters
yeah.
he's doing it in. So, you know, their claims would all stand up to me if they would just show that they, you know, the names of the people that were in that boat or the specific, you know, drug cartel that they're targeting something so that we can put that to bed. But it doesn't bother me at all if it is what they say it is, it doesn't bother me at all.
I mean, I think another part of this, and that's absolutely right, is just the immiseration and ruin of Venezuela itself. I mean, this is a country that is blessed with enormous natural resources, you know, oil most of all, that was a very wealthy country.
Oh, and Caracas was a destination for people.
And has become... I mean, third world is an insult to the third world. Yes. I mean, it is a ruined, miserable, suffering place. And, you know, this is me sounding a little neocon-y, but like, I think it's, you know, if you were to think about like what are places where it's really in our interest to have a different regime.
Right.
I mean,
you do sound neocon, because I would say, even with everything you just said, that wouldn't be enough of a reason for America to spend money and potentially put troops on the ground or whatever, or you just use military force. But if you bake in the China connection and Iran, then you have a real interest.
This is a country that's really allied with our, you know, in Russia with our enemies. Yeah. I mean, so it's really a sort of bad actor. Now, of course, the American track record of involvement in Latin America is piss poor. But I actually think, you know, maybe, I mean, proof is in the will be in the pudding. But I think, you know, it seems to me sort of well-crafted strategy of you know, not directly intervene, but, you know, Maduro stole the last election, right? So he's an illegitimate ruler, adverse to American interests. You know, I think the bounty is largely symbolic. I don't even know how that would work. Like, is someone just going to kind of like kidnap him, or maybe, but, you know, but turning up the pressure, you know, I think is a good thing. I think if we talk a lot about limiting Iran's kind of ring of fire around Israel, but, you know, Venezuela is also a country deeply infiltrated by Iran, with a massive Hezbollah presence. So I think they're real national security kind of concerns.
Right. And our people are dying of fentanyl overdoses, and they're part of that problem. So that's reason enough.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see, though. I mean, I think your point of a kind of like, okay, how much of an escalation do we really want here? And what are the off ramps or the guardrails? I don't think there's any appetite for American troops in Venezuela.
No. And I think it's just fair to say, you know, if you allow the American government to blow boats out of the water and not fully detail who and what they're, you know, targeting, then even if you're happy in this circumstance, in the next one and the next one after that, you might not be so happy. So I just want to make sure that they're doing this the right way. But again, I'd like them to keep doing it the right way.
I know, just on a human level, anecdotally, you know, I have a number of friends and family friends who are, you know, refugees from Venezuela, and specifically Jewish refugees, and they just have described horrific anti-Semitism, and vicious anti-Israel sentiment, and you know, confiscation of property, you know, things you read about, you know, from the 20th century. I mean, it's really that bad. And I think because it's, I know it's Latin America, we kind of like don't, I know we don't focus on it enough, but, you know, real people who love that country and love their homeland, you know, have had to leave.
Yes. And look at the change. Look at El Salvador. Look at Argentina. You can see something emerging here that's really amazing and could be great for
even
the
Dominican
States.
Republic, you know, is better than it.
Yeah, it's better than it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
So our Make It Make Sense section, we're going to tackle the Voting Rights Act. The case is Louisiana v. Calais. You know, just to kind of a quick and dirty potted history, you know, the Voting Rights Act is a product of the 1960s, 1964, Lyndon Johnson. The idea was to sort of, the most controversial parts of it were that the federal government would supervise voting in the former Confederacy, and that those states would then have to prove that they were fair or not discriminating to get kind of relief from that, you know, big brother looking over their shoulders. There are other provisions as well, a lot of which
But the point was to offer equal access, right, to black Southerners as to white Southerners.
Right. Because of the tradition of preventing black Americans from voting. So it was meant to give teeth, right, to the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed the right to vote. So Okay, so we're now kind of like, you know, decades later, this court has shown great skepticism towards the Voting Rights Act in recent years. There's a case called Shelby County. Basically, the understanding was, this court maintains, that those were kind of measures that might have been necessary then, but shouldn't be, you know, eternal. That they were kind of departures from a kind of colorblind approach that might have been, again, required or demanded because of the extent of persecution and discrimination, but now just read as, you know, as violations of another amendment, the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law. So, you know, the oral arguments were yesterday.
Specifically in this specific case in Louisiana, the argument, I think, and just correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are, what, six districts, and there was only one that was black majority. And so a few years ago,
they created a second one
because of the Voting Act.
Right.
And now they're challenging that second district because they're saying the Voting Act doesn't apply here. There was no actual restriction on people voting. You're just creating another voting block based almost on equity, it sounded like. Right. You know, the outcome has to be sort of one-third of the population and one-third of the districts, but that's not what the Voting Act was for.
Right. In civil rights law, there's this question of, do you need discriminatory intent or discriminatory effect?
Yeah.
Right? And it's a big question, you know, sort of, what if I look at something, I say, okay, you know, of these 100 people of any kind of process, you know, 99 of them are white. Yeah. Is that racist? Even if angels made the process, so there are questions there. Just as a little more background, the court has ruled that it won't review gerrymandering because it's a political question, right? The maps are drawn by Congress. And that's why we're seeing like this like war of gerrymandering war in California and Texas. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the Supreme Court has said it's a political question, not a legal question. The issue here is, you know, the question of race, and furthermore, race as a proxy for political affiliation, right? That is part of the issue here, is that these are, you know, safe Democratic districts, right? And that eliminating this second one would have really negative effects on Democratic chances. So all that gets like kind of thrown in the hopper. I listened to oral arguments a little bit, you know, and I think the court is going to overturn this last vestige of the Civil Rights Act. Certainly, you know, the question, Clarence Thomas has been flying this flag for a long time. And John Roberts he wrote Shelby County, and the Chief Justice, I think, is deeply skeptical, along with the other conservatives, of the role that race is playing, you know, in this, in the application of this law.
And notably and reliably, Justice Jackson, in her oral arguments, you know, just sort of said the most bizarre thing, which was she compared this to the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and sort of said it's a disability that blacks have in Louisiana that they somehow, she couldn't explain how, she didn't, why there's a disability, why you can't vote. That seemed racist to me.
Yeah.
And therefore, this second district has to be protected, even though it's defined racially. But wouldn't you have to demonstrate some kind of obstruction that doesn't allow people to vote based on their race? She just didn't do that. She just assumed that it was there.
Yeah, yeah. That was a really interesting moment. I think what she was getting at was to say that, like, this is sort of not that blacks are disabled, but that it's analogous to how we treat disability, right? So if
there's no ramp and I'm in a wheelchair,
right,
you have to build a ramp so I can get in and vote.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter if, you know, I was – you know, if I was ableist, there's just no ramp, right? I need a ramp, right?
What's the comparison?
So the question is,
I
think the argument would have been in the 1960s or 50s, Jim Crow, whatever, that there probably were disabilities in terms of the ability to vote.
Right, but so what? We're in 2025.
Right, so that's
what's her argument then?
So that's a question of like, that's what I was saying, like, what is the legacy here? And like, it kind of is going to turn on whether you still think we're a racist society. I mean, to be blunt, right?
But like even if everyone in Louisiana were racist, which is ridiculous on its face, what's the impediment or the obstacle to a black woman walking into a voting booth in November and voting? Yeah. There just isn't any. Doesn't matter if everyone hates you for your skin color. If you can vote,
Right. I mean, if someone's blocking you, okay, that's one thing. But like,
She was making an emotional argument, a DEI argument to me, to my ear, but not a legal one.
Yeah. I mean, she said that. She said that, you know, we live in a society where these legacies are still alive. Now, the question is like,
Live in a society that voted Barack Obama in twice,
plenty of
black men and women are elected officials.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, the question of sort of, you know, are you owed, you know, you're owed your vote counting, right? So it's counted, everyone's vote counted, but you're not really owed voting in such a way that like the outcome is guaranteed, right? Like I'm owed, you know, if I go cast my ballot for whoever, you know, that has to be counted, but I'm not owed a win, you know? So
no, but in the equity understanding of the world, you are. And that's why I call this equity, because that's how
and
she sees it.
And I'm owed representation that looks like me.
Right.
Right. And that is basically jerry-rigged, gerrymandered to create a certain outcome.
Right. And it's a racist idea because it suggests that people who have your same skin tone represent you well just because they share your color, which is not true. Right. So
I think, you know, part of it would be, you know, if the efforts, gerrymandered efforts have largely centered on, you know, the tricky thing here is the overlap of race and politics, right? So, you know, largely Republicans have tried to not have concentrated black districts, but to distribute those votes in larger districts to, you know, but that's kind of the way the cookie crumbles. Now, there's no guarantee, again, the connection between race and politics is pretty strong in a lot of places, but maybe it's attenuating and changing. Yeah. I mean, you have black Republicans now, you know?
Yeah. Well, so whichever way this comes out, but it sounds like they're going to, you know, get rid of that second district. What does this do to the Voting Rights Act? Anything? The Voting Rights Act is not impacted, but the way it is used.
Yeah, I mean, over time, though, if you gut it, I mean, over time, you know, it's not going to be explicitly overturned, but as its provisions no longer, you know, are read stringently and no longer read in a sort of way that have teeth, it'll just become, you know, it's a big law. So there are like lots of provisions in it. But, you know, there is an effort here to dismantle the parts of it that feel very, you know, 60s-y.
Well, it does
have
teeth, doesn't it? Like if a group of, you know, BLM activists stood in front of voting an election office and stopped white people from coming in.
For sure.
And if a bunch of KKK members, that act would still be the tool they use. Right?
Right. And there's a constitutional right to vote. And, you know, if you're blocked, you can do it. So, you know, it's more kind of like how aggressively is it applied?
Yeah.
And where are the outer bounds of the ability to sort of like, you know, what is demanded in terms of drawing districts and is race a factor? I mean, I think, you know, what's really interesting is all these voting right cases are come from the South because, you know, this is this sort of Shelby County and this one, you know, there's also, it's also kind of one thing I was thinking about was, you know, as we get more distant from the civil rights era, there'll be fewer and fewer people maybe who like were impacted or remember it, and how we think about that in a larger way about like a changing
America.
Doesn't
it alarm you? And some, just you're a lawyer. We have a justice on the Supreme Court who is not making legal arguments. She's making DEI arguments and emotional arguments and maybe personal arguments.
Yeah.
But you know, isn't she supposed to be judging the law, not how she feels about the law? And that's really what I heard here was she was saying, you know, there's nothing to do with the law and I can't prove my position, but I'm just going to push it forward because that's how I feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think the role of, you know, what are justices, you know, influences or, you know, Clarence Thomas writes that, you know, his approach to the law is born of growing up in a shack without running water and without electricity. And, you know, I think in one sense, what's interesting in a lot of these cases is that, you know, it's the conservative judges who are sort of, you know, want the status quo overturned. And so you have the liberal justices kind of in retreat with a lot of these precedents that are you know, whether it's Roe v. Wade or here, like kind of being clawed back. So I think it's definitely being on the back foot. I think it's definitely being defensive. I think it's definitely trying to figure out, you know, how to, in the face of very strong conservative majority, how to salvage stuff. But, you know, a lot of these precedents, as you said, Rekha, you know, were, you know, written in the 60s and 70s at a very different political moment, you know, when the court was a kind of like the vanguard of the left in America. We're in a different situation now. Okay. Okay, good stuff.
Sunburns and sunlight.
Okay.
Sunlight.
You know, I mean, it's not necessarily an undertold story, but I think it's a story worth watching. Is one thing I've spent a lot of time this week thinking about are, you know, all these cases against James Comey and Letitia James and maybe Adam Schiff and John Bolton soon. And, you know, I wonder what Americans think about all this stuff. I haven't seen polling yet, but, you know, we ran an editorial saying hopefully, or maybe it's like, you know, you get one side gets their punch in, the other side gets their punch in, and then hopefully like things kind of like burn out a little bit. I don't know, or whether we're just going to have kind of all these lawsuits till the end of time. But
who's in the most trouble of the people you just named?
Right. So that's the right. You know, I think the case against, and we haven't seen the indictment yet. I think the case against Bolton is going to, you know, I think these classified documents case, I mean, Trump got out of it because he was reelected, but they're hard to fight. I mean, if they find the documents and they shouldn't be there, you know, you're kind of in trouble. I think, you know, it was brought initially under the Biden administration, which suggests, you know, that sort of both sides have had some questions here. Now, whether it's really meritorious, I mean, I'm someone who, I don't know John Bolton personally. I think he's, you know, been a pretty, you know, pretty good civil servant. I'm not sure. I don't have any animus against the guy like Trump does. But, you know, I think the Comey and James cases are weaker, but we'll see. I don't know. I wonder about this, you know, the prosecution of political enemies. Like you said about Bibi, it's not good. Mm. You know, elections should be won or lost at the ballot.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. I guess the Bolton, you know, the documents thing to me seems bad, but yeah, like move on.
Yeah.
But the Comey thing sticks with me and Schiff. Like the thing that they did itself might not seem like a big crime, but the implications of their crimes were huge and I think deliberate and therefore deserve to be punished so that people don't do that again.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point that, what, you know, people say one of the, you know, one of the virtues or points of punishment is deterrence.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. My sunlight is just Congressman Chip Roy of Texas has introduced a legislation that he's calling Preserving a Sharia-Free America Act. And I really want to get Congressman Roy on the show to talk about it because, you know, they have real trouble in Texas with something called Epic City, which is a huge mosque being built and housing and community centers around it. And they've been talking about making the whole area Sharia compliant. And it sounds like a freedom of religion issue, but actually Sharia law is not about freedom of religion. It's a separate legal system that actually conflicts with the American legal system. And there's no room for two legal systems in one country. And I think it's an important point. We've seen this all over Europe. And it feels, again, maybe because of what you said before, we are a huge country with these two oceans on either side. So things like this seem small and like we're focusing on minor problems. There aren't that many Muslims in America. There aren't that many who care about Sharia law. But the minute you allow for another set of laws to be equal or maybe more important than the set of laws that we have in our country, you get yourself into a world of trouble. And I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a Sharia Free America Act of some sort. I haven't seen the details of his specific act. To prevent something worse coming down the pike.
Yeah, I like it. It's a hot take. That would be a good column.
Yeah.
I wonder, though. I mean, I think it's a really interesting, fair point about two legal systems. I mean, I think this way about, you know, Jewish Beit Dins in a way. I mean, if you want to opt into them, maybe for civil matters, you know, obviously that's what to do. But it's strange. It's right. You know, even the ability to go to a different kind of court and how those two legal systems interact
does very explicitly say that, you know, the law of the land dominates and you are subject to it, and you can't construct your own law that conflicts with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. But if you're in, you know, if you're in New Square or Borough Park and, you know, you want to get a divorce, let's say, I mean, you're kind of going to be bound by, you know, whatever court you go to. Okay. So my sunburn, I was going to do, but I'm not going to do your boy RFK's suggestion of a link between circumcision and autism. I felt that maybe I was like conflicted. You know what I mean? Like I'm not unbiased.
It would explain a lot of hedge fund managers.
I was just
going to
say it. But I'm going to talk a little bit because it is debate day here in New York. Mm-hmm. About Zora Mamdani's interview on Fox News. And that's having it both ways. I mean, he's asked about should Hamas disarm. He says in a way that's just so smug and kind of like, I'm New York needs to be more affordable. And it's so disingenuous because he's obsessed with Israel.
Yeah.
This notion that somehow he's always asked about it and he just wants to talk about buses. And in fact, it's actually the opposite. Mm-hmm. It's his driving, as it is for so many on the left. It's not one issue among many. It's his driving issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said in the last week, I'm not a Zionist. Having, you know, Congregation Bethlehem having him was appalling, honestly. And that's been sort of well covered. You know, he is who he is at this point, and no one will be able to say they didn't know. No one can say, you know, they weren't warned beforehand.
Yeah, I think that's important too. Is you know, for all the hair on fire about his not being a Zionist, which doesn't even bother me that much. It's the least of his bad things to worry about. But you know, it's not working. Nobody cares. It seems that he's not a Zionist or that he, you know, won't condemn Hamas, whatever. Yeah. And so maybe, you know, the way to beat him is not to keep beating that drum, but to talk about other things.
But
to know that that's what we're getting.
But the way you need a messenger. I mean, you can have a message, and there is no messenger.
Correct.
That's the problem.
All right, we'll watch the debates tonight, and hopefully we'll talk about it next week. And just quickly, my sunburn is there's a recent study that came out that showed a meaningful drop in the number of undergraduates, particularly at elite schools in America, who are identifying as transgender and non-binary. The numbers went from 3% in 2021 up to 7%. Imagine almost 1 in 10
social contagion,
of American
if there ever was one.
Undergraduates were calling themselves transgender or non-binary in 2023 and 3% in 2025, back down to its original rate. So what could explain that? And the people who did the study, you know, went through all the reasons, and they basically said, you know, two things sort of stood out. One is the decline in mental health issues since COVID, and the correlation between mental health and people who declared that they were transgender is obvious. But I think it's also clear that this was a fad. It's just like so many other fads that has passed, the difference being that this did permanent and irreparable damage to young people. Yeah. And adults allowed it, profited off of it, continued to profit off it.
They're just barbaric.
Yeah, it's a lifetime of misery for the people who've been through this. And so even if you're part of that 4% that came back to your senses, your life has changed if you've been on hormonal therapy in your late teens let alone had surgery. So, you know, it's good news that maybe we're ending the madness, but what a shocking thought that teenagers and people who are in their early 20s are so susceptible to fads that they could be driven to do self-mutilation effectively, and that adults could participate in child sacrifice. It's something to really worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Rebecca. We'll see you next week.